Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, my wonderful audience. Some of the best folks in the field of mental health and psychology and psychiatry and social work and counseling and other folks from around the world. So glad you are my audience. I'm going to jump right into talking with my guest today because she has a commitment that requires she leave early. Now, this is the first time, 2-3 years of show I have here, my tens of thousands of listeners, that someone has to leave early. So we will rush right to Beth Darnell, and at the end, I will come back and spend a few minutes with you talking about issues that came up, and maybe I'll do some of my ginger news flashes that I usually start the show with. Beth, are you there?
I am here, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and you sound clear as a bell, too.
Perfect.
Well, Beth Darnell is a very interesting human being. It's going to be good to have her on the air. I'm looking forward to perhaps doing some work with her together in the future. Beth is a clinical associate professor in the Division of Pain Medicine at Stanford. Associate professor in the Division of Pain Medicine at Stanford. She's a PhD psychologist, so she is a pain-oriented, pain-specializing psychologist. Her new book is Less Pain, Fewer Pills. And the subtitle, listen carefully, the subtitle is Avoid the Dangers of Prescription Opiates and Gain Control Over Chronic Pain. It's a 2014 book. I think it sounds like she belongs here. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Peter. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, why don't you take off on your new book and what you're doing, and then I'm sure we're going to find a lot to talk about.
Absolutely. You know, and I just have to say right out of the gate that I think it must have been 15 years ago I purchased Toxic Psychiatry, and I still have it today. I don't think I mentioned that to you, so I thought I would do that now.
You don't know what that means to me. You don't know it's a ritual on my show at the end to ask folks if they were influenced by my work, and it's almost always goes way back to Toxic here, unprompted.
Yes.
You start out the show. I'm done. Take over. Talk about what you want.
Well, I'm really delighted that you mentioned my book. It's really just hot off the press, published in July from Bold Publishing, and it's a topic very near and dear to my heart. You know, I'm a pain psychologist. I've been working with people with chronic pain exclusively for about 15 years, and my goal as a pain psychologist is to help people live their best life possible within the context of having chronic pain. And really, my love is empowering people to harness their mind-body connection to control their own experience or to best control their own experience, whether that's mood or pain. You know, there's not so much distinction between the sensory experience and the psychological experience. More and more, there's convergence in the data and just also in the literature and through our own understanding of the mind-body connection. And I really enjoy bringing awareness to that truth and working with people individually and also in groups so that they're able to gain as much control as possible with as few pharmaceuticals as possible.
Are you saying that pain controls the mind and the mind controls pain and it's a reciprocal kind of relationship?
There is definitely reciprocity there, absolutely. You know, all pain is processed in the brain, no matter where it is felt in the body. I describe the brain as, you know, the pain computer. And I think that's a useful description, because when we feel pain in various areas of the body, we can get really focused on that part of the body without appreciating as much that pain is actually processed in the brain. And it's some of the same regions of the brain that are involved with pain processing are also highly involved in the processing of emotions. And for that reason, there's this bidirectional relationship between sensory pain and also emotional pain. And so feelings of sadness or depression can increase feelings of sensory pain, and vice versa. There's a very clear physiological reason why we see this overlap between the two.
One of the things I find in dealing with my patients who have pain is the big question on their minds is, how much can I control my pain? Am I helpless in the face of my pain? Are my emotions in the face of my pain going to overwhelm me? How much can I possibly play a role in how much pain I feel and how it affects me?
It's a brilliant question, and one that comes to everyone's mind. Anyone who has chronic pain is going to wonder about that. So the truth is, we have more control than we understand or know about. And so this is sort of the secret of pain psychology, is that there is a level of control that can be harnessed. And I like to use the example of pain catastrophizing to illustrate this concept. And pain catastrophizing is something that can happen naturally and automatically when we have pain, whether it's acute pain or chronic pain. But it's also something that really works against us. And here's what it is. Catastrophizing is when we're over-focused on pain. We can't seem to think about anything else, so we're magnifying it, we're ruminating about it, and we're feeling helpless about it. So focusing on pain, expecting, oh my gosh, you know, the pain may get worse, and what are going to be the negative consequences if my pain continues to get worse? And it's easy to find ourselves in that type of a catastrophizing mindset when we're living with pain and the challenges of pain. But here's the thing, even though it's natural and understandable that we might catastrophize our pain from time to time or even fairly regularly, the data is really clear and consistent that catastrophizing is toxic. It's literally toxic. And what do I mean by that? There is about 25 to 30 years of science behind catastrophizing that shows that it's one of the most potent predictors for pain outcomes. So catastrophizing is associated with greater pain intensity, greater disability from pain. It actually predicts the development of chronic pain. So people who catastrophize are more likely to actually acquire chronic pain after surgery or after an injury. It predicts surgical healing. It predicts rehabilitation after a surgery, and it predicts response to pain treatments of all kinds. It predicts how well you're going to respond to physical therapy, to medications, and to interventions, including surgery. Some of the data suggests that catastrophizing is actually more potent a predictor than disease characteristics themselves. So we spend a lot of time focusing on the disease or the condition or what's causing the pain. And as humans, we tend to overlook one of the most important assets we have available to us, which is our own brain. Because the brain can override a lot of what doctors are trying to do for us. Out in, you know, in the clinic or in the hospital, doctors can be administering, you know, various treatments. But study after study after study is showing that this one psychological predictor is so important. It can reduce your response to those treatments. So you're not a passive participant. You're actually participating with your doctor with these treatments. And your frame of mind can determine a certain percentage of how much your pain improves or not.
Now, I know that some of my patients would respond to me when I say that because my approach is the same as yours. It's identical. I didn't know about the huge amount of research, and I'd like to talk a little more about that if we get a chance. But I know that one of the things I might hear back would be, well, I didn't catastrophize until I had my catastrophe. You know, I didn't
yes.
catastrophize until this terrible thing happened to me. And this amount of pain, I don't see it ending. It's been with me for 5 years or whatever the amount of time. And it's the pain that in reality is making me catastrophize. Let's talk about that. How do you respond?
Well, absolutely, and rightfully so. What I say to people is, you're absolutely justified in catastrophizing. You have a very potent stimulus, you know, pain, and there it is. But catastrophizing doesn't help. So it's something that, again, is natural and understandable. But what is important to understand is that it is an very clear example of using your brain to your disadvantage. Unwittingly so. Nobody wants their pain to be worse, but catastrophizing actually worsens pain. So the example that I will use in my classes, and I think even in Less Pain, Fewer Pills in the book, the example I give is imagine that your pain is a campfire. You know, it's a small campfire, and you live with it, and you know that pain well. It's a part of your life, and you must negotiate the challenges of living with that campfire. When we catastrophize, when we get into that psychological mindset and catastrophize pain, it's the equivalent of picking up a can of gasoline and pouring it on that fire. So it really exacerbates the pain. Essentially, what it does is it amplifies the pain processing in the brain. So sensory pain, I mentioned in the beginning that pain is processed in the brain, and some of the regions of the brain that are involved in pain processing are some of those emotional centers of the brain. And when we catastrophize and we trigger those negative emotions and the focus, the hypervigilance about the pain and feeling negatively about it, we are essentially amplifying some of those pain processing in the brain. And there are studies, fMRI imaging studies, that have shown this to be true. So there's really clear science behind this and how it's working at the neural level. And so, sure, you have pain, and catastrophizing is something that you would be justified in doing. But I ask people, do you really want to pick up a can of gasoline and pour it on the fire, on your pain, and stoke it? And the truth is, nobody wants their pain to be worse. Nobody wants their pain to be worse. But if we don't have the right tools and knowledge, and, you know, if we don't have the right plan in place, this is what can happen, you know, unwittingly. This is what's happening automatically with many people. And so this notion and the topic of pain psychology is understanding how all of this fits together within the context of the science and a person's own experience of their pain, understanding how it fits together, and then acquiring the right skills and tools so that a person can begin harnessing the power of their mind-body connection to actually create a greater sense of comfort, less distress, and ultimately less pain.
Now, your book, Less Pain, Fewer Pills, actually will help people look at this. I haven't seen the book. I don't think I've got a copy.
You need to get a copy, Peter.
Well, tell your publisher to send me a copy.
I'll do that.
I think this book is very relevant to my own thinking about things. And it sounds like you've tried to tailor the book to actually helping people who have pain.
Absolutely. It's really written for people who have chronic pain. And I've been working with people with chronic pain for many years, as I mentioned, and I found myself telling, you know, the same information, the same stories over and over again. And I really wrote the book because there was just a gap. There was no book I could point people to. There was nothing really talking about pain in this way. And there were a lot of people who were looking for alternatives to medications, but there wasn't anything specific to this topic. And so for that reason, I just decided to write it myself. You know, I need a resource to give my patients. And so this was my solution.
Tell all of us about the setting you work in and what kind of success do you have and how much do you end up being able to take people off of pain meds or any psychoactive substances. A little bit about your experience.
Sure. Great question. So I, as a pain psychologist, I work at Stanford University in the Stanford Pain Management Center. Before I came to Stanford, I was working at Oregon Health and Science University in the Comprehensive Pain Center. And at this point in time, I am doing a lot of different research studies. And so I'm in the clinic a little bit less now than I was in the past, particularly in Portland, Oregon, where I was doing the majority of my time was clinical work, and it was very focused on helping people acquire the right information and the right skills, all towards the goal of helping people simplify their pharmaceutical regimen. And the reason for that, the rationale, is that almost every person I would work with would say that they didn't want to take the medication, but they didn't know what else to do. And I really feel like, you know, the majority of people in the community, they share the same sentiment. Nobody wants to take medication. We take medication because we have symptoms and we're trying to manage symptoms. And I come at it from the perspective of, wouldn't it be lovely if you could manage some of these symptoms in other ways, if you just had the right tools and the right information? So this is what I do. You know, specific to pain, there's a great need for this information, because for all of the reasons of what I've talked about and many, many others, I wish we had several hours, but the information is there, certainly. I would work with people one-on-one to develop a plan tailored to them, to help them not only acquire the right skills, but to implement them. You know, it's really about retraining mind and body in various ways.
Is this pretty cognitive that you're talking about?
Definitely, a lot of pain psychology is rooted in cognitive behavioral therapy. But pain psychology is more than that. It's also pain education. It's also neuroscience education. And it's teaching people how to calm the nervous system, ultimately. When we live with chronic pain, we are contending with chronic stress. And the body responds to pain, whether acute or chronic, with a stress response. And part of the solution, let me take a step back. This stress response actually changes some of our muscular patterns, neuromuscular patterns, some of our cognitive patterns. The brain is actually changed by chronic pain itself. The antidote for some of this is to recondition mind and body towards the relaxation response. This helps take away some of the negative consequences of living with pain. Some of the negative consequences of living with pain are a glue that holds together some of these negative patterns in the nervous system. And what we're looking to do is discharge those patterns. And the way to do that is through a daily plan. You know, you get on a program and you self-treat. You basically, you know, you dose your medicine on a regular basis. But in this case, the medicine is it's a behavioral skill set that I teach people. And some of it's tailored to the individual, but a lot of it's fairly predictable and specific to people who have pain. And so it's getting on that program, and what people are surprised to learn is that they have the ability to change their experience in very short order in ways that they never understood before.
Is some of it relaxation techniques? You mentioned that.
Indeed, yes. What I do is teach the relaxation response from the scientific perspective of, you know, you're slowing heart rate, you're slowing respiratory rate, you're reducing the level of tension in the body. You're also calming the entire nervous system, brain and body. This is critical. Again, this is the antidote to pain responses, those automatic pain responses that that actually facilitate pain processing. So a big part of it is learning a basic skill set that serves as the antidote to the stored consequences of chronic pain. That's a big part of it. Other pieces to a personalized plan include taking a look at a person's thought patterns and their emotional patterns, then their behavioral patterns. And those three pieces, you know, there are whole chapters on each of those topics, but those are some of the big pieces that go into developing a comprehensive plan for how a person can best manage their pain with as little medication as possible.
Do you end up looking at all in a traditional psychotherapy way at why somebody's catastrophizing, how the pain may be making them fall into some of their helpless patterns in childhood?
You know, it's a good question. Pain psychology as a discipline is often fairly time limited. It's fairly brief in the grand scheme. And so for the most part, you know, deep issues from childhood will not be explored in detail. I will say that in individual practice, though, if there is specific trauma that whereby there are consequences, ongoing consequences of trauma, those need to be addressed. So let me unpack that. If a person has been traumatized at some point in their life and they have current symptoms of heightened anxiety or formal post-traumatic stress disorder, that does need to be addressed before they will gain much traction with pain psychology. And the reason for that is very basic, that the anxiety will serve as the overriding influence in the brain and will not allow for some of these relaxation principles to take hold. So actually addressing that is an important part of the treatment.
Certainly, if we're looking at veterans, a lot of them are going to have a lot of post-traumatic stress associated with their injuries and their pain. Is that true much in the civilian population, or a lot of people directly from car accidents or something like that, or are most more subtle, like, you know, back pain and joint pain? What do you mostly deal with in a pain clinic?
Yeah, a wide variety. Certainly in a pain clinic, there's less of a presence of formal post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's absolutely a component, a major component of what we see and deal with as pain psychologists. Again, you'll see the highest rates in a VA hospital, no question about it. But many people, chronic pain comes from all sources. I mean, some people have congenital issues, there's cancer pain, there's post-surgical pain that never resolved, injuries, certainly accidents, and that's generally where you see PTSD, but we also see PTSD independent from a person's source of their chronic pain. So for instance, if a person may have been sexually abused as a child and have post-traumatic stress disorder surrounding that later in life, developed chronic pain, and we see them in the pain clinic, and they happen to be comorbid with PTSD from a childhood event. That's actually fairly common. Post-traumatic stress disorder is a risk factor for future acquisition of chronic pain, again, because the nervous system is primed for it.
What about women? How much do you see women who are suffering from disorders that are unique to women, endometriosis, maybe a cyst that was removed, painful menses, things like that, and their relationship to abuse issues? Do you see that kind of thing much?
Well, there are patterns, certainly. The reality is that women are more likely to acquire chronic pain than are men. They're more likely to experience pain of greater intensity, of longer duration as well. And so women simply experience more pain and worse pain than men. And then, as you mentioned, there are pain conditions that are also specific to women, you know, certain types of pelvic pain, the menstrual pain, as you mentioned, some of the fibroids. So, you know, you also look at the literature, and we know that women are also more likely to have a history of abuse as well. So there is that co-occurrence and sort of, you know, relationship between abuse being a very, very trauma or abuse being a very, very clear predictor for future chronic pain. But women are also just primed to have more pain, and some of that has to do with sex steroids, hormones. Some of it has to do with women's brains being more attuned to some of the emotional aspects. Women are more likely to have anxiety or depression, for instance. And as I mentioned earlier, they share overlap with chronic pain. Sensory pain and the emotional pain share major overlap.
What about the fact that some people are able to use hypnosis to undergo surgery for dental work? First of all, how real is that, and how much does it relate to the possibilities of people doing mind over matter through self-hypnosis or hypnosis or, you know, some other method of self-suggestion?
Yeah, so the brain is an amazing thing, isn't it? And I think your question taps into multiple layers. I mean, one, you know, just sort of, you know, how much are people tuned into the power of suggestion? And also, you know, we're really getting into that territory of placebo effect. You know, what's placebo? What's the non-specific effects of a certain intervention? You know, what is just patients' expectations. I like to tell a story about some really cool research that is done in the UK, and this is a woman named Irene Tracy. She's an amazing researcher, and she did some work looking at opioid medications and expectations and how expectation can change the effect of opioid medications. So in this experiment, she took a group of people, brought them into the lab, and these are all people with chronic pain, and placed an IV in their arm and told them that they were going to be getting a very powerful opioid medication. It's one of the most powerful ones. This one was remifentanil medication. So people are expecting this pain medication, and so this was administered to them, but there was deception in this study. So while they were administered something, what they were really administered was saline. It was a salt water solution, essentially a placebo. But people thought they were getting the opioid medication, right? But they really weren't. And they had people rate their level of pain relief. And even though they weren't getting any opioid medication, but when they thought they were, they rated significant pain relief from the placebo from the saline. And then they flipped the experiment and they said, okay, well, you know, now we're going to give you just the placebo, salt water, nothing for the moment. And, you know, just please rate your pain. And the deception here was that they actually administered the remifentanil to them at that time. And what was revealed in the results of this study was that when people believed that they weren't getting any medication that was effective, when they believed that they were just receiving the placebo, they rated their pain relief from the remifentanil that was being administered. That was, the effectiveness was reduced by 50%, 50%. And so this example, I think, this elegant study is a clear example of how the mind, how the brain can override the capacity of medical treatments, even opioid medication. Your brain is stronger than opioid medication. Now, to be clear, when people were getting, you know, thought they were just getting the saline, the placebo, they didn't rate no pain relief, but it was reduced by 50%, which is massive. It's a massive percentage in medical research. I mean, it's just a phenomenal effect. And so it's an exquisite example of how we participate.
I got to go to break. This is fabulous. Folks, stay with us. This is great information. Got to go to break. This is a great half hour. Thank you. Thank you, Beth.
Thank you.
We'll come
sure.
back with Beth Darnell, pain specialist and author of Less Pain, Fewer Pills, in a few minutes. And this is Dr. Peter Greggin, and I'm back with my really interesting guest, Beth Darnell, clinical associate professor in the Division of Pain Medicine at Stanford University, and she's the author of Less Pain, Fewer Pills, Avoid the Dangers of Prescription Opioids and Gain Control Over Chronic Pain. I was asking Beth something that's of interest to me and I think to an awful lot of people, and she didn't really give me a lot of response to this particular question, so we're going to go over it again, which is, what about these claims that you can actually just, if you're a good hypnosis subject and you have some good hypnosis, well, you can do major surgery under hypnosis and certainly go to the dentist and have your tooth filled or removed or whatever. What's the true story on that, Beth?
So interesting. I mean, you know, we do hear about this, and I hear about it more from individuals because I work, you know, very specifically with people with pain. There are certainly people who have the capacity to go through those surgeries, and really they put their mind to it. They have an extreme resolve about it, and they are able to undergo some self-hypnosis where they are take themselves into a very deep state of relaxation where they do not actually feel pain. And, you know, it's not a common experience, but I do think the fact that it happens is a testament to the capacity of the human mind and body to have those experiences. I think it is very interesting, and I think it gives us clues as to where we might go in the future. Again, you know, harnessing that potential that seems to exist, at least for some people. How do we optimize that? One of the things that comes with my book is an audio CD. It's a relaxation response audio CD that is enhanced with binaural technology. So what is that? Binaural means that there are sounds that go in one ear and then in the other ear, just tones. And so you need to use headphones when you listen to it because there's subtle tones that are going to go in one ear and then in the other ear. It's these binaural beats. and this is behind, you hear it very subtly behind my voice as I guide a person through a deep relaxation. So why do I include this binaural in the audio CD? Well, you know, this is an interesting concept, and it touches on your question about self-hypnosis and what's possible for pain control. I won't go through all of the history about binaural. Just in the interest of time, I will bring us all the way up into the mid-90s when there was some research that was done using binaural technology during surgery. And so what the researchers did was they put everyone under anesthesia for surgery. So everyone's unconscious, right? And so there's no placebo effect happening because people are unconscious. They took a third of the surgical group and they had them listen to a binaural cassette during the surgery. So their brain is hearing the binaural, even if the person isn't aware of it. The other third of the group just listened to a relaxing music. So they, you know, what's the effect of the relaxing music? Sort of a control. And then the third group just listened to nothing. It was actually a blank tape. And the researchers observed the response to the surgery. What they discovered was that the group that listened to the binaural sounds required significantly less anesthesia during their surgery than did the others who did not have the binaural audio during the surgery. These findings were fascinating and replicated in other surgical populations. Now, what does this tell us? What does this all mean? Why do we even get anesthesia? Well, we know we get anesthesia.
First, remind us what binaural is.
Binaural. So bi meaning two, oral meaning auditory or audio. So it's what binaural is they are tones, sounds that go in one ear and then in the other ear. So a tone will enter your right ear and then a tone will quickly go in your left ear and then back in the right and then back in the left. And so it's rapidly alternating tones into your ears. So what this does is it stimulates each hemisphere of your brain in rapid alternating succession. And this appears to assist with encoding of information. What this study has also shown us is that the binaural technology also has the capacity to calm the nervous system. People required less anesthesia during the surgery. Well, we know we get anesthesia so we don't feel pain. You know, we are knocked unconscious so that we're not aware of what's happening during the surgery. But your anesthesiologist is in the operating room with you the whole time you're having surgery. And what they're doing is they're watching that heart rate monitor, and they're watching your heart rate, they're watching your respiratory rate. And when your heart rate starts to climb, your respiratory rate starts to climb, that's when the anesthesiologist knows that they need to dose you more anesthesia. Now, the people who listened to the binaural audio, the heart rate was kept lower, the respiratory rate was kept at a lower rate, and they required significantly less anesthesia during the surgery. So what this tells us is that the binaural has the capacity to calm the nervous system on a much deeper level than otherwise. And that's the reason why I include it in this audio CD. I include it so that, think of it as relaxation on steroids. We all know that the relaxation is beneficial for pain, but this is the additional layer that helps you achieve a deeper response. And binaural is also associated with improved learning and coding of information. So I'm also helping people encode these very deep states of relaxation.
Can the folks who are listening here buy this off your website?
It's available on. So here's the thing: if you buy the book, it comes free. It comes with the book. But if you want to buy a standalone audio CD, it's available through Bold Publishing.
Bold Publishing.
Bold.
Okay.
B-U-L-L. B-U-L-L.
Like bold,
Publishing.
Like malarkey. Bold. Bold Publishing.
Yes. BoldPublishing.com.
You've got 2 minutes before you need to leave. Particular thoughts? Has been a great interview. Any particular thoughts you want to leave folks with?
You know, I think what I'd love to communicate most to the listeners, and especially to people who may be living with chronic pain, is that please explore working with a pain psychologist or explore pain psychology resources. I have a column on Psychology Today on pain psychology. I am very passionate about educating people about the benefits of using psychology and learning ways to really optimize your own power and your own capacity to improve your own experience. Ultimately, this means fewer doctors, fewer pills, fewer medical expenses, and I think that that works to everyone's advantage.
We've been talking with Beth Darnell, PhD, psychologist, professor in pain medicine at Stanford, and her book, Less Pain, Fewer Pills. Beth, thanks for taking time out, and you and I will be talking about other things over the coming year, and I will certainly have you back on the show soon. Thank you for being
here. Please do. I would love to come back. Thanks so much, okay. Peter, and take care.
You're welcome. And folks, the show is not going to end. We got 15 more minutes with me, just plain me. You know, Beth raises an issue, several issues, innumerable issues that relate to our everyday living, to psychological well-being, this idea that it is heavily demonstrated that catastrophizing predicts chronic pain and severity of pain, and that it's the most potent predictor of whether or not people will get well, whether they'll do better, or whether they're going to stay stuck with chronic pain. This is what I've thought, and this is how I've based my own therapy, and it's really interesting to me to hear that there's a lot of good research confirming this. Now, the same thing is true in every aspect of our lives. See, when we catastrophize, we basically, we have a, Houston, we have a problem. I'm assuming I'm still on the air. I'm checking with my engineer, and I'm still on the air. And I think this must be Dr. Darnell's phone. Is that what you think is going on, engineer? I think that's what's going on. I think we should be free of it soon. I can't wait to tease her about leaving me with the remnants of her phone call. But the catastrophizing is so critical. When you catastrophize, you imagine the worst, you think there's nothing that can be done about it, and you tend to give up. So not only do you suffer the awful feelings of anxiety or depression or hopelessness that go along with catastrophizing, you are not working at your effective best to manage your life, to make things come out better. You're not as likely to try a relaxation exercise. You're not as likely to examine your thinking processes and figure out how you can best cope with the pain. Now, some folks catastrophize in part because they feel that no one's listening to them. People catastrophize because they feel that the only way they can get across how desperate they feel and hopefully get the help they need is by explaining how bad things are. This doesn't work. What that will do to you if you're going to most pain doctors is you just get more meds, and in the long run, that's going to make things worse. If you're going to a psychiatrist, they're going to just up your doses. And if you're going to a therapist, they're going to recommend you go to a psychiatrist. So catastrophizing with that feeling of hopelessness and helplessness is under it, while entirely understandable, really hurts us. Boy, we're having interferences left and right here today.
so that this catastrophizing just makes things worse. And catastrophizing can be built into us from childhood. When we're children, we are helpless. We are at the mercy of all kinds of feelings of guilt, shame, and anxiety. And we're at the mercy of whether we are loved and taken care of, and whether there are people there for us to rely upon. And that can be really grossly missing in childhood. And so we grow up with the sense that there's always something bad that's going to happen to us. And we grow up with a sense that we don't even want to wish for anything. An aspect of catastrophizing is maybe the underlying feeling that it's hopeless to wish for anything good. But in fact, we do have huge control over our lives as we reach into adulthood, and often to some extent in childhood. And it's always best to approach everything we do, sniffing out the helplessness that we're prone to feel, sniffing out the catastrophizing, and always approaching things in the most positive, best way we can. On top of everything, I'm sneezing. This is going to be a catastrophe. But no, it's not. I'm going to surmount all of what's happening technologically, allergy-wise. Now, I want to go to my ginger news flashes that she always prompts me with before each show. And these are important because they will keep you on top of the issues in psychiatry and the way the media handles them. So here's the latest news flash, July 8th, 2014. Boy, are we on top of things. That's just yesterday in Science Daily, which is a great source of information, by the way. It's just got all kinds of stuff in it across the psychological, social, medical sciences. The headline is Link Shown Between Inflammation in Maternal Blood and Schizophrenia in Offspring. And this is from the source is Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. It's a press release. I don't have the study in front of me. But what they found was they say that if you've got an increase in your C-reactive protein, then the risk of schizophrenia in your offspring is increased. Well, what is C-reactive protein? It's a sign of inflammation. It's a very, very general thing. So what does this mean? I suspect absolutely nothing. We'll see what happens in the future. I'm reminded of going way, way back to the revolutionary days when the gentleman who's got his face on the emblem of the American Psychiatric Association, whose name I'm undoubtedly going to block on, but he was a great founding father, when he did autopsies that found inflammation of the brain in every case of mental illness. I don't know where this thing is going to go. But let me give you some other things that came out about the same time. Another newsflash. It's from HypeWatch, another dementia blood test oversold. And it's about how another marker for dementia in the blood has turned out not to be working out at all. The original one was highly touted, but now researchers writing in Alzheimer's and dementia have found out that this thing just isn't going to work out the way it was touted. We also have coming out right now a review of a giant multi-billion-dollar project, the Human Brain Project out of Europe, that was supposed to tell us all about the human brain, about its relationships to mental health, neurological diseases, and so on. Well, I could have told you this wasn't going to work because we don't know enough about the human brain, what its operating system is, how it works. You know, we don't have the equivalent even of a Galileo looking through telescopes when we're looking through microscopes, because we just don't have any overall concepts about brain. And they
they're now coming to the conclusion, as one of the big researchers concluded, that the main apparent goal of building the capacity to construct a larger scale simulation of the human brain is radically premature. And so I would say that a good way to look at all this is that all the biological claims that have been making that you hear in the field of psychiatry, whether it's about your brain, whether it's about your specific biochemical imbalances, whether it's about the C-reactive protein in the blood of pregnant women and so-called schizophrenia, which I do believe will never be shown to be a disease anyway, that this stuff just isn't going to work. For thousands of years, we could go back to Hippocrates and show you how physicians have always wanted to show that depression or sadness, what used to be called melancholia in the old days, way back in the times of the Greeks and the Romans, that it was medical in origin. And Benjamin Rush, who was the name I was trying to pluck out of my brain a few minutes ago, he wanted to show with all his heart, being a physician and one of the early people to think of himself as a psychiatrist, signer of the Declaration of Independence, that he found in autopsy after autopsy that mentally disturbed people had inflammation of the brain. And from the very beginning, when manic depression was defined in 1899, now it's called bipolar disorder, by Kraepelin, the assumption was it was biological and it was genetic. And you know, we had probably the most convictions throughout the world that mental disorders were biologic in the 1930s. And it was one of the things that was used to justify Hitler's sterilization programs, was that we had all these hundreds of research papers showing the genetics of schizophrenia and other disorders. And none of them have proven to be valid. None of them have been repeatedly shown to have some scientific value to them. They're all gone now. Kalman's research. Kalman was a Nazi psychiatrist who was so radical that the Nazis didn't like him, so he emigrated to the U.S. It's literally true. He wanted to sterilize people in Germany who were eccentric. He thought if we could sterilize all the eccentrics, then we'd get all these genes we can't find that were contributing to schizophrenia, and we'd wipe out schizophrenia. So Kalman wasn't liked. Can you believe that? So he came to the U.S., where he was beloved, and he had all these fake and misinterpreted twin studies trying to show schizophrenia was genetic for the purposes of politics, which most of this is all about. And so the Nazis went on and had a sterilization program. It was the first legislation put on by Hitler under Ernst Rudin, who was a psychiatrist there. And as some of you know, and you can find on my website, if you check out Murder of Mental Patients or the Psychiatric Holocaust under my scientific papers, a lot of psychiatric thinking went into the Holocaust, including the psychiatric euthanasia program, which was again based on these people are physically, mentally defective. These people are genetically defective. It's a blessing to them and us to kill them. And it was the psychiatric euthanasia program back in the 30s, built on the science of the genetics and biology of mental illness, that actually opened the whole way to the Holocaust. So that the medical experts, the Holocaust, from the U.S. and from Germany, the independent people at the second Nuremberg trial, the doctor's trial, concluded that we couldn't have had the Holocaust. Psychiatry couldn't prove, hadn't have shown in Germany that you could do the mass extermination of people in killing centers, shipping them there in railroad trains, killing them with fake wooden soap, you know, to make them think they were in showers, and then pumping engine fumes they were using then into the shower. So
So this is a really serious issue, this all this fake biology in psychiatry. It's not just some small thing. Right now it fuels the billion-dollar pharmaceutical industry. Right now it convinces millions and millions of people around the world, tens of millions in the U.S., that they should be taking psychiatric drugs when there's just no evidence for a biological and genetic problem within the brains of folks who suffer. Suffering has been with us for a long time. It's a part of the human condition, and the solutions are well developed in psychology and spirituality. You can do more for your brain than your brain can do for you. You can have more effect on how well it functions than your brain's going to have on how well you function. The brain you've been given, you can develop. And if there's one great message from Dr. Beth Darnell today, it's that even if you have pain, you can use your mind over your matter and over your pain. Thanks a lot for listening, folks. Thank you very much.